This is a systemic problem. Money is mostly in the hands of the wealthy. That's not unique to cryptocurrency. So that is that really the issue? Not to me. Is crypto used to complete criminal transactions? Yeah, some. I mean, apparently not that much. One interesting thing was when the Silk Road got shut down, it was believed that the Silk Road was basically the vast majority of Bitcoin transactions. And with the Silk Road shut down, Bitcoin transactions would fall to almost zero. It didn't happen. Crypto transactions barely declined when the Silk Road was shut down. The dollar has been used for way more crimes than Bitcoin has. It's just a reality. It doesn't tell us one thing or the other. I'm not defending anything. Does Bitcoin mining, not all crypto, but does Bitcoin mining have a carbon footprint? Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's imperative. I mean, it's not going to be sustainable unless that's dealt with either through alternative energy. Like that's a problem that's got to be dealt with. And also the legacy dollar and banking industry has an insane carbon footprint. All the dollars that are brought by tourists to Europe are then flown back to the U.S. Do you understand the carbon footprint of that? Armored cars everywhere, insane infrastructure of banks, the overhead, they have private jets. I mean, it's, if you want to talk about that, let's talk about it, but let's also consider other banking and monetary instruments in the carbon footprint. People hear this and they go, but it's not the same. Well, just compare one by one. And my view on crypto is nothing is only good. The internet, oh my God, child porn, scams, right? But the internet exists and it's going to exist. So we've got to control the child porn and the scams. The stock market, it's rife with scammers, fake financial advisors, Ponzi schemes. Yes, we have to deal with that. But investors, investing in the stock market is not going to end. Cars, I mean, they put out emissions and people die in car accidents. Yeah, but cars are going to exist. We're not getting rid of cars. So let's make them green. Let's switch to electric. Let's make them safer. Let's redesign our roads. I'm not even an evangelist that it crypto exists. It doesn't seem to be going anywhere. I put a small portion of my assets in monthly dating back to 2015. And that's it. I don't have all my eggs in there. If crypto ends and goes to zero, I lose what is now 3 to 5%. If it does well, then I do it. It's not something in and of itself that we should have this reflexive reaction to. And the problem is that when the left takes that view, they just miss out on participating in how to properly regulate crypto, and they leave it to, I don't know, the libertarians or whoever. Let's take a more balanced view, please. We've got a great bonus show for you today. Sign up at JoinPack.
Would you like to take the sounds of your favorite radio station to places you never thought possible? Well, now you can, because WRCT is live on the internet. Just point your browser to www.wrct.org and click on our live MP3 broadcast. Now you can go out of town without any feelings of loss or regret for leaving us behind, because we're just a mouse click away. WRCT, live on the internet. Because why should Pittsburgh have all the fun?
My fellow Americans, I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
Depose from the faint. Do you think I'm hot? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
For those of you concerned with your health and the new USDA organic product standards, WRCT Pittsburgh would like to inform you that all our DJs are genetically modified to bring you best music.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me. For all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of nuclear holocaust. It's a very serious problem, and one that faces all of us. Fortunately, here at WRCT Pittsburgh, we broadcast from a steel-reinforced concrete basement. So we'll be playing music long after your sorry corpse has evaporated in a blinding flash of light and heat. I hope this thought comforts you. WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. Now and forever.
Chad, Guinea, Sudan, Burkina Faso over the last 18 months. Several of the coups were led by U.S.-trained officers. We'll get the latest. Then to Minneapolis, where protests are continuing after police fatally shot Amir Locke, a 22-year-old black man who was sleeping on a couch during an early morning no-knock raid.
They saw a black man reach for his gun, not knowing anything about Amir. And then they shot. I mean, they didn't even give him a chance.
We'll speak to attorney Ben Crump, representing Amir Locke's family. Plus, we go to Oakland, where a group of teachers have entered the eighth day of a hunger strike to protest a plan to close and merge over a dozen schools.
Oakland is not for sale.
No school closures.
Oakland is not for sale.
No school closures.
We'll speak with one of the striking teachers. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. President Biden said Monday that a Russian-built pipeline to carry natural gas to Germany will be abandoned if Russia invades Ukraine. Biden made the remarks during a joint news conference at the White House with Germany's new chancellor, Olaf Scholz. Scholz did not explicitly state Germany would suspend the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, though he said the U.S. and Germany were aligned in their positions. In Brussels, European Union Commission President Ursula von der Leyen said the EU is exploring other options for its energy supplies, which would include fracked gas from the United States.
We are building a partnership for energy security with the United States, which is primarily about more liquefied natural gas supplies. We are talking to other gas suppliers, for example, Norway, about increasing their supplies to Europe.
Also on Monday, French President Emmanuel Macron met Russian President Vladimir Putin at the Kremlin. Putin said Russia is still working to find a diplomatic solution to the crisis over Ukraine, but warned of a wider nuclear-armed confrontation if Ukraine joins the NATO military alliance. The Washington National Cathedral rang its bell 900 times on Monday in a somber tribute to 900,000 U.S. residents who've died of COVID-19. At the Capitol, members of Congress held a moment of silence and candlelight vigil to mark the occasion. The U.S. has a far higher per capita death rate from COVID-19 than other wealthy nations, even though vaccines have been widely available to most U.S. residents for months. Meanwhile, an increasing number of Democratic governors have announced plans to roll back mask mandates. California, Connecticut, Delaware, New Jersey, and Oregon said they'll end statewide mask mandates, but would allow municipal governments and school boards to require masking. This is New Jersey Governor Phil Murphy.
We're not going to manage COVID to zero. We have to learn how to live with COVID as we move from a pandemic to the endemic phase of this virus.
The Homeland Security Department has confirmed it's testing robot dogs on patrols along the U.S.-Mexico border. The agency said the four-legged drones produced by the Philadelphia-based company Ghost Robotics would help boost the presence of Border Patrol in the region. Officials also admitted the harsh terrain in the southern border can be life-threatening and that robots would reduce the agent's exposure to the hazards. Last year, at least 650 migrants died while attempting to cross into the U.S. as the Biden administration continued to block most asylum seekers from safely coming into the country through posts of entry. In October, Ghost Robotics showed off an autonomous weapon system combining a quadruped robot with a sniper rifle. Costa Rica's crowded presidential election is likely headed to a runoff as preliminary results show no candidate got the required 40% of votes needed to declare victory. Businessman and former president José María Figueres has taken an early lead in Sunday's election, with former finance minister and World Bank official Rodrigo Chávez polling in second place. The election comes as Costa Ricans are denouncing growing unemployment, increasing living costs, and corruption. Sunday's presidential election had 25 candidates, the runoff scheduled for April. The Biden administration's confirmed it quietly banned former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez from entering the United States and placed him on a list that tracks corrupt Central American officials last year. The State Department said Monday it added Hernandez on its corrupt and undemocratic actors list in July, citing multiple credible media reports and sworn witness testimony accusing Hernandez of aiding in drug trafficking and using drug money to finance his campaign. Hernandez's right-wing regime for years was backed by the U.S. government despite numerous reports of human rights violations. Hernandez's brother was convicted of cocaine trafficking in the United States in 2019. A warning to our audience, the following story contains graphic descriptions of police violence. In Brazil, thousands of people took to the streets of Rio de Janeiro, Sao Paulo, and more than a dozen other cities across Brazil over the weekend, demanding justice for Moise Kabagambe, a 24-year-old Congolese refugee who was beaten to death last month. Kabagambe was attacked on January 24th after he demanded back pay from 2 days of work at a Rio de Janeiro beach kiosk where he served beverages. Security footage shows three men repeatedly beating Kabagambe with a club and a baseball bat over the course of 13 minutes. This is one of the protesters.
The Brazilian state is racist. It is a Nazi state. It is a homophobic and xenophobic state, and it has to stop. We are here at this huge protest in solidarity with all the families who suffered these barbaric crimes.
Moise Kabagambe's family left Congo and fled to Brazil in 2011 when he was a child. Back in the United States, the Supreme Court restored Alabama's congressional voting map, reversing a federal court ruling that found Alabama Republicans unlawfully gerrymandered the districts to deny representation to black voters. The maps give Alabama just one congressional district out of seven that's favorable to a black candidate. Monday's 5-4 ruling by the Supreme Court will allow Alabama to keep the gerrymandered maps through November's midterm elections while justices consider a ruling that could further undermine what's left of the Voting Rights Act of 1965. First Lady Jill Biden says President Biden will no longer promote 2 years of tuition-free community college as part of his Build Back Better agenda. Dr. Biden spoke Monday at the Community College National Legislative Summit in Washington, D.C.
Joe has also had to make compromises. Congress hasn't passed the Build Back Better legislation yet. And free community college is no longer part of that package.
The White House is no longer actively negotiating with Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, who've refused to support the Build Back Better bill. Democrats currently have just 49 senators available to vote in the 100-seat chamber after New Mexico Senator Ben Ray Lujan suffered a stroke and is not expected to return for weeks. In media news, calls are growing on Spotify to remove Joe Rogan from his platform after the popular podcast host promoted misinformation about COVID-19 on his show and as a video resurfaced showing Rogan making repeated racist comments. On Friday, Grammy-winning singer India Arie joined other artists who've pulled their music from Spotify as she shared a viral video showing Rogan using the N-word on his show 24 times. This is an excerpt.
Like, you know, the thing.
Yes. Saying the word.
I already said
D is just like saying
she's calling you a like this boy that he's a but starts calling them.
Other resurfaced videos show Joe Rogan saying black people have different brains and comparing a neighborhood with no white people to the Planet of the Apes. In response, Spotify has quietly deleted scores of past episodes of Joe Rogan's podcast, but CEO Daniel Ek has refused to cancel Rogan's exclusive contract with Spotify, reportedly valued at over $100 million. In a memo to Spotify workers, Ek wrote, quote, "Canceling voices is a slippery slope." In response, musician Neil Young urged Spotify workers to quit, writing, quote, "Get out of that place before it eats up your soul." Board members from some of the most powerful big oil corporations are on Capitol Hill today to face questioning by the House Subcommittee on the Environment. This comes as the oil and gas industry is facing mounting backlash over its contribution to the climate crisis, including a massive campaign of disinformation that spread lies about the catastrophic dangers of fossil fuels, despite big oil's own research warning carbon emissions from its products were triggering a climate emergency. Ahead of today's hearings, Committee Chair Ro Khanna released a video promising to hold big oil accountable.
So we are going to have the big oil company executives in for the first time ever in Congress to testify about misinformation. It will be like the big tobacco hearings.
This hearing marks the beginning of a new relationship between Congress and the tobacco companies.
We are going to be going after Chevron, BP, Shell, a number of these companies to see what their practices are.
Congressmember Khanna will be joining Democracy Now! As a guest later in the week. And Todd Gitlin, one of the founding members of Students for a Democratic Society, has died at the age of 79. Todd Gitlin helped organize protests against racial segregation in the Jim Crow South and apartheid South Africa. He was also a leading opponent of the Vietnam War. He went on to become a professor of culture, journalism, and sociology at NYU and Columbia Universities. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, on August 18th, 2020, soldiers in Mali toppled President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita, sparking a wave of military coups across Africa. Last April, a military council in Chad seized power following the death of Chad's longtime president, Idriss Deby. Then on May 24, 2021, Mali witnessed its second coup in a year. On September 5th, the armed forces of Guinea captured the nation's president and dissolved Guinea's government and constitution. Then on October 25th, Sudan's military seized power and put Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok under house arrest, ending a push in Sudan towards civilian rule. And finally, 2 weeks ago, on January 23rd, Burkina Faso's army leaders, led by a U.S.-trained commander, deposed the nation's president, suspended the constitution, and dissolved parliament. That's six coups in five African countries in just under a year and a half. Over the weekend, the African Union condemned the recent wave of military coups. This is Ghana's president, Nana Akufo-Addo.
The resurgence of coup d'etats in our region is in direct violation of our democratic tenets and represents a threat to peace, security, and stability in West Africa.
The African Union has suspended four of the countries, Mali, Guinea, Sudan, and most recently Burkina Faso. Many of the coups have been led by military officers who have received U.S. training. Those U.S. officers. The Intercept recently reported U.S.-trained officers have attempted at least nine coups and succeeded in at least eight across five West African countries since 2008, including Burkina Faso three times, Guinea, Mali three times, Mauritania, and the Gambia. To talk more about this wave of coups across Africa, we're joined by two guests. Samar Abolushi is an anthropologist at University of California, Irvine, focusing on policing, militarism, and the so-called war on terror in East Africa. Her forthcoming book is titled War Making as World Making. Brittany Mache is an assistant professor of environmental studies at Williams College, where she focuses on conflict and environmental change in the West African Sahel. Brittany, let's begin with you, Professor Mache. If you can talk about this region of Africa and why you believe they are undergoing this number of coups or attempted coups.
Thank you, Amy. It's great to be here. So one of the first comments that I want to offer is that often when these kinds of things happen, it's easy to sort of put a frame of inevitability on all of these coups. So it's easy to just say that West Africa or the African continent writ large is just a place where coups happen, as opposed to asking really complicated questions about both the internal dynamics, but also the external dynamics that help contribute to these coups. So as far as internal dynamics, that can be things like populations losing faith in their governments to respond to basic needs, a kind of general disaffection, and a sense that governments aren't actually able to be responsive to communities, but also external forces. So we've talked a little bit about the ways that commanders in some of these coups, especially thinking about Mali and Burkina Faso, were trained by the U.S. and in some cases also France. So these kind of external investments in the security sector effectively harden certain sectors of the state to the detriment of democratic governance.
And Professor Michel, you mentioned France as well. Several of these countries were part of the old French colonial empire in Africa, and France has played a large role in recent decades in terms of their military in Africa. Could you talk about this impact as the United States begins to exert more and more influence in Africa and as France pulls back in terms of the stability or instability of a lot of these governments?
Yeah, I think it's really impossible to understand the contemporary African Sahel without understanding the disproportionate impact that France has had, both as the former colonial power, but also as a disproportionate economic powerhouse in the countries, basically exerting economic influence, resource extraction across the West African Sahel, but also in setting an agenda, especially over the last decade, which is really focused on strengthening militaries, strengthening police, strengthening counterterrorism operations across the region, and the ways that, again, this effectively hardens the security forces. But I also think, especially thinking about the U.S. Influence, that the U.S. in attempting to sort of carve out a kind of new theater for the war on terror in the West African Sahel has also contributed to some of these negative impacts that we've seen across the region. And so the interplay of both the former colonial power and then also what has been described by activists on the ground as a kind of new imperial presence by the United States, I think both of these things are effectively destabilizing the region under the kind of auspices of advancing security. But what we've seen is just increasing instability, increasing insecurity.
And in terms of this instability in the region, what about the issue, obviously, that has drawn the United States' attention increasingly in the area, of the rise of Islamic insurgencies, whether from Al-Qaeda or ISIS in the region?
Yeah, so even as kind of global terrorism networks are active in the West African Sahel, so Al-Qaeda and the Islamic Maghreb, but also offshoots of ISIL, I think it's important to think of the violence that's happening across the Sahel as really localized conflicts. So even as they tap into some of these more global networks, they are localized conflicts where local communities are really feeling that both the kind of state governments are not able to respond to their needs, but also increasing both competition over a sense of governance and accountability mechanisms, but also a kind of general disaffection and the ways that people perhaps see armed revolt, armed opposition, as one of the few avenues left to stage claims, make claims on governments that they see to be really absent and non-responsive.
Professor Michel, in a moment, we want to ask you about the particular countries, but I wanted to turn to Professor Samara Belushi, anthropologist, University of California, Irvine, who focuses on policing militarism and the so-called war on terror in East Africa, contributing editor for the publication Africa is a Country and a fellow at the Quincy Institute. If you can give us the overall picture of this area when it comes to militarism and particularly the U.S. involvement in terms of training the officers involved in these coups. I mean, it really is astounding. In the last 18 months, what we have seen, this number of coups, in no time in the last 20 years have we seen this number of coups across Africa in this amount of time.
Thank you, Amy. It's good to be with you on the show this morning. I think you're absolutely right. We do need to ask about the broader geopolitical context that has emboldened these military officers to take such brash actions. Between the U.S.-led war on terror and the wider international community's fixation with quote-unquote security, this is a context that centers, if not privileges, military solutions to political problems. I think there's a tendency in the mainstream news outlets reporting about the recent coups to place external players outside the frame of analysis. But when you factor in the growing role of the U.S. Military Command for Africa, which is otherwise known as AFRICOM, it becomes clear that it would be a mistake to interpret the events in these countries as the product of internal political tensions alone. For listeners who are not familiar, AFRICOM was established in 2007. It now has approximately 29 known military facilities in 15 states across the continent. And many of the countries, as you mentioned, that have experienced coups or coup attempts are key allies of the U.S. in the war on terror. And many of the leaders of these coups have received training from the U.S. military. Now, the combination of training and financial assistance, coupled with the fact that many of these quote-unquote partner states allow the U.S. military to operate on their soil, has meant that these African states have been able to vastly expand their own security infrastructures. For example, military spending on armored police vehicles, attack helicopters, drones, and missiles has skyrocketed. And whereas the militarism of the Cold War era prioritized order and stability, today's militarism is defined by a constant readiness for war. Up until 20 years ago, few African states had external enemies, but the war on terror has fundamentally reoriented regional calculations about security, and years of training by AFRICOM has produced a new generation of security actors that are both ideologically oriented and materially equipped for war. And we can think about the ways in which this turns inward, right? Even if they're trained for potential combat outside, we might interpret these coups as, you know, as a turning inward of this kind of framework and orientation towards war. Because the U.S. and its allies rely so heavily on many of these states for security operations on the continent, many of these leaders are often able to consolidate their own power in a way that's largely immune from external scrutiny, let alone critique. And I'd even go a step further to suggest that partner states like Kenya, joining the war on terror has actually played an instrumental role in boosting its diplomatic profile. It seems counterintuitive, but Kenya has been able to position itself as a quote-unquote leader in the war on terror in East Africa, and in some ways championing the project of counterterrorism is not simply about access to foreign aid, but equally about how African states can ensure their relevance as global players on the world stage today. The last point that I want to make is that I think it's incredibly crucial that we don't reduce these developments purely to the effects of imperial designs, because the national and regional dynamics absolutely matter and warrant our attention, particularly in the case of Sudan, where the Gulf states may currently have more influence than the United States. So we just need to recognize the risks that come, of course, with broad sweeping analysis like what I'm offering you here when we're talking about often vastly different political contexts.
And Professor Belushi, in terms of you mentioned the vast amount of military aid that has gone from the United States to these countries. Some of these are some of the poorest countries on the planet. So could you talk about the impact that has in terms of nation building, in terms of the outsized role that the military plays in these countries, even as a source of employment or income to the sectors of those populations that are part of or aligned with the militaries?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. And I think it's important to keep in mind here that the kind of aid that has been channeled into the continent is not limited to militaries and to the military domain. And what we see when we start to look more closely is that a securitized approach and a militarized approach to all social and political problems has effectively taken over much of the entire donor industry in Africa in general. Now, this means that it becomes very difficult for a civil society organization, for example, to obtain a grant for anything other than something related to security. And there's been some documentation in recent years that shows the effects of this kind of colonization of the aid sector on populations across the continent in the sense that they're not able to get funding for much needed issues, you know, whether it's healthcare, whether it's education and that type of thing. Now, I do want to mention here that in the case of Somalia, we can see there are the African Union has deployed a peacekeeping force to Somalia in the wake of the Ethiopian intervention, the U.S.-backed Ethiopian intervention in Somalia in 2006. And we can start to see, if we track the funding that has been used to support the peacekeeping operation in Somalia, we see the degree to which a growing number of African states are increasingly reliant on military funding, in addition to the funding that comes directly to their military governments for training purposes. They're increasingly reliant, their troops are increasingly reliant on funds from entities like the European Union, for example, to pay their salaries. And what's really striking here is that the peacekeeping troops in Somalia receive salaries that are often up to 10 times what they earn in their home countries when they're just, you know, deployed in kind of standard form back home. And so we can begin to see how many of these countries, and in Somalia, it's Burundi, Djibouti, Uganda, Kenya, and Ethiopia, that have become increasingly reliant on a political economy that is structured by war, right? We see an emergent form of migrant military labor that has had the effect of protecting and offsetting public scrutiny and liability for governments like the United States, right, which would otherwise be deploying its own troops to the front lines.
Professor Brittany Miche, I was wondering, you are a specialist in the Sahel, and we're going to show a map of the Sahel region of Africa. If you can talk about just its significance, and then focus particularly on Burkina Faso. I mean, the facts there, you in 2013 met with U.S. Special Forces who were training soldiers in Burkina Faso. It is just the latest in a coup where the coup leader was trained by the U.S., the U.S. pouring more than $1 billion in so-called security assistance. Can you talk about the situation there and what you found in talking to these forces?
Sure. So I want to sort of offer a kind of general framing comment about the Sahel, which is oftentimes written off as one of the poorest regions in the world, but actually has played both an integral role in kind of global history, sort of thinking about the mid-20th century and the emergence of international humanitarian assistance, but also continues to play a really key role as a key supplier of uranium, but also becoming a kind of target of ongoing military operations. But to speak a little bit more about Burkina Faso, I think it's really interesting to sort of return to the moment of 2014, where then leader Blaise Compaoré was ousted in a popular revolution as he attempted to extend his rule by rewriting the constitution. And that moment was really a kind of moment of possibility, a moment of a kind of revolutionary sort of idea about what Burkina Faso could be after the end of Compaoré's 27-year rule. And so in 2015, I met with a group of U.S. Special Forces who were conducting these kinds of counterterrorism and security trainings in the country. And I asked very pointedly if they thought that given this moment of democratic transition, if these kinds of investments in the security sector would actually undermine this process of democratization. And I was offered all kinds of assurances that part of what the U.S. military was in the Sahel to do was professionalize the security forces. And I think in looking back on that interview and seeing what has subsequently happened, both the attempted coups that happened less than a year after I conducted that interview and now the successful coup that has happened, I think this is less a question about professionalizing and more a question of what happens when war-making becomes world-making, to take up Samar's book title, but when you sort of harden a specific sector of the state, undermining other aspects of that state, rerouting money away from things like the Ministry of Agriculture, the Ministry of Health, to the Ministry of Defense. It's no wonder that a kind of strongman in a uniform becomes the kind of most likely outcome of that kind of hardening. I also do want to mention some of the reports that we've seen of people celebrating these coups that have happened. So we saw it in Burkina Faso, in Mali, we also saw it in Guinea. And I don't want this, I would sort of offer this not as a kind of anti-democratic sentiment that sort of infuses these communities. But again, this kind of idea that if civilian governments have not been able to respond to grievances of communities, then a leader, a kind of strong leader who says, I will protect you, becomes a kind of attractive solution. But I would sort of end by saying there is a robust tradition, both across the Sahel, but in Burkina Faso in particular, of revolutionary action, of revolutionary thinking, of agitating for better political lives, for better social and community lives. And so I think that's what I'm hoping that this coup does not sort of tamp down on that, and that there is a kind of return to something amounting to democratic rule in that country.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. It's a conversation we will continue to have. Brittany Mache is a professor at Williams College, and Samara Obalushi is a professor at University of California, Irvine. Next up, we go to Minneapolis, where protesters have taken to the streets since last Wednesday after police fatally shot 22-year-old Amir Locke. He was sleeping on a couch as they conducted an early morning no-knock raid. His parents say he was executed. Activists say police are trying to cover up what really happened. Stay with us. Inside my head there is a dream that I want to see in the sun. Behind my eyes there is me that I've been hiding for much too long. Because I've been too afraid to let it show that I'm scared of the judgment that may follow. Always putting off my living. Show my face. It's getting lucid for so long. Freedom is mine today. I gotta step out on faith. It's time to show my face. Procrastination had me down. Strength, Courage, and Wisdom by India Arie. On Friday, the four-time Grammy Award winner joined other artists who've pulled their music from Spotify in protests of racist comments made by podcaster Joe Rogan, as well as Rogan's promotion of misinformation about COVID-19. Arie put together a video of Rogan saying the N-word endless times. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Before we begin our next segment, a warning. It includes graphic footage and descriptions of police violence. Daily protests are underway in Minneapolis after police fatally shot 22-year-old Amir Locke during an early morning no-knock raid last Wednesday. The Minneapolis Police Department released a video of the raid the next day that shows a SWAT team wearing gloves and full tactical gear use a key to enter his cousin's apartment. Within seconds, they find and shoot Locke, who is not a suspect in their warrant. He's asleep on the couch. In the 14 seconds of footage, an officer is seen kicking the couch where Locke was laying on that couch, wrapped in a blanket, holding a gun he was licensed to carry. He appears to be woken up by the officers. At a news conference Thursday, Minneapolis Interim City Police Chief Amelia Huffman said the officer who shot Locke saw the barrel of his gun emerging from the blanket and pointed in the officer's direction. Her comment outraged longtime police accountability activist, attorney Nakima Levy Armstrong, co-chair of the city's working group on community safety, who interrupted the news conference to speak out.
I'm not a threat. I don't have a gun. Okay? Don't treat me like I'm a threat. This is what I would call the anatomy of a cover-up. This is unacceptable. I'm sorry it is. When I agreed to work with you on the work group, we talked about the importance of transparency and accountability. And here, what we are seeing is business as usual. And you know this, Amelia. You know this, Jacob. I don't know how you guys slept that night. I couldn't sleep at night. Tears from a mother's perspective, thinking about what happened. I saw the picture of Amir. He looks like a boy. My son is 17 years old. He has slept on his friends' couches for sleepovers. So we cannot sit here and whitewash this and pretend that it's okay.
A memorial for Amir Locke has been set up in front of the interim police chief's home. His parents have joined protests calling for justice in their son's death. This is his mother and father, Karen and Andre Locke, speaking Friday.
Man, I didn't think my son, I've seen it happen. I've seen it happen too many times. I have to think of my mother right now. I'm sorry. Let her rest. She'll tell me to straighten it up and speak straight. But and me being one of the stronger ones of the family, I have to get it together.
At the end of the day, I believe that he was executed by the MPD, and I want the police officer that murdered my son to be prosecuted and fired.
Yes. Killing. The police killing of Amir Locke in Minneapolis comes less than 2 years after Minneapolis police murdered George Floyd. It's renewed scrutiny on the use of no-knock raids. Louisville police killed Breonna Taylor in a similar raid. Now, back in Washington, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Monday President Biden may consider a federal policy that limits the use of no-knock warrants by certain federal agents.
President Biden, the reason he has been such a strong supporter, one of the reasons, of the George Floyd Justice and Policing Act is that it would further restrict the use of no-knock warrants across the country, incentivizing funding by using funding as an incentive. We have been engaging with, as you know, civil rights groups, a number of law enforcement groups, all agree on the need to reform the use of no-knock warrants. There's a lot of agreement on that to keep both citizens and law enforcement officers safe. And the president is examining the possibility of extending those restrictions to other federal agencies through executive actions that he would have the power to do.
For more, we go to Minneapolis to speak with Nakima Levy Armstrong, the Minneapolis-based civil rights attorney, activist, founder of Racial Justice Network, and former president of Minneapolis NAACP. Also with us, leading civil rights attorney Ben Crump, part of the Amir Locke family legal team. Nakima, let's begin with you. There you were standing, interrupting the news conference of the police chief and the newly reelected mayor, Jacob Frey. Explain what it is you're demanding right now. You said they were not telling the accurate story of what happened.
Absolutely. I think it was very jarring for many people in our community to see Amir painted almost like a criminal with a gun, you know, waiting on police, pointing a gun at police. That's essentially what was alluded to by the statements that came forward from the Minneapolis Police Department. It was Amir Locke's family who reached out to let me know the truth from their perspective, even giving us Amir Locke's name, as well as the fact that he was a licensed gun owner. He was asleep on a couch. He wasn't named in the warrant. That is information that might not have come forward for days if it were not for the Locke family doing their own homework to find out the truth. Now, in terms of our current demands, I think that it's a no-brainer that the officer who shot and killed Amir Locke be fired as well as prosecuted. And the interim chief, Amelia Huffman, also should be fired or should resign for her role in what I would call a cover-up.
And I wanted to ask Attorney Ben Crump, what was the Minneapolis Police Department looking for when they came to that house? And could you talk about the no-knock warrants origins. It's for many Americans, it's a clear violation of the Fourth Amendment, your right to be safe in your persons and property and your home. But yet it has spread over the past few decades across the country.
Certainly, you've asked several questions that are profound, and I think each of them merit a response. But I want to say first, on behalf of Amir Locke's family and many in the community, thank you to attorney advocate Nakima Levy, my sister, who's always on the front line with us, George Floyd, Dante Wright, now Amir Locke, and so many other families. It's because of people like her that we start to see some measure of accountability, some measure of justice. And when we think about this injustice that happened here, you really think about it being Black History Month and the importance of history. Have we just studied our recent history from Louisville, Kentucky, how Breonna Taylor, this innocent Black woman, was mutilated by 9 bullets while she was practically naked in her own home when the Louisville Metropolitan Police busted in her front door at 1 o'clock in the morning and caused literally her death, even though they lied to the police to get the probable cause affidavit. These no-knock warrants, if Minneapolis should have learned anything from studying recent history, is that they have deadly consequences for innocent Black people like Amir Locke and Breonna Taylor and so many others that we don't even talk about. And you ask, what were they looking for? That is a perfect question, because the no-knock warrants are an extension of this war on drugs that we know disproportionately targeted Black and brown people. And the fact that St. Paul Police Department, who were having the warrant executed with the assistance of Minneapolis Police Department, did not ask for a no-knock warrant. No, the no-knock warrant was insisted upon by the Minneapolis Police Department, even though the mayor has said after George Floyd that they were not going to have no-knock warrants anymore. And as we understand it, it was a search for property related to a possible connection to a homicide. So you scratch your head and say, on a hunch, you just eviscerate our Fourth Amendment rights, and you see them do this over and over again to marginalize people of color. They don't do this to our white brothers and sisters, but they so flagrantly disregard the Fourth Amendment rights against unlawful search and seizure when it comes to Black people. And we see over and over again that this has devastated impacts on Black families.
Nakima Levy Armstrong, the significance of the White House weighing in at this point, they're talking about federal agents. That wasn't the case in this case. Is that right? And again, I mean, just to show, what do they expect? And I want to show that video again, just at the beginning. We're not showing the video of the execution, but just the gloved hand with a key in the door, opening this door. I think of Philando Castile, who also had legally had a weapon and even said to the police officer who was killed in his car, sir, I have a legal weapon. And then he is shot dead. And in the same way, you've got Amir Locke, who legally had a weapon. Within seconds, he is dead, arising from a, I'm horrified to say, dead sleep. But the significance of the White House, that's federal agents, what it would mean here. Did you understand there was a stopping after the Breonna Taylor case of these no-knock warrants in Minneapolis?
I'll take that question first, Amy. Mayor Jacob Frey issued a statement, I believe in November of 2020, saying that he had essentially banned no-knock warrants. He also ran on that particular reform, announcing that he had banned no-knock warrants when he ran for mayor. And that was a part of the reason why some people decided to vote for him for re-election. And what we are seeing that happens in Minneapolis and in other jurisdictions is that sometimes in the rush to respond to what the community is asking for, you will have elected officials who will put out statements of a reform that they made, but that does not mean that there is proper implementation of a particular reform in those situations. So with Minneapolis, someone was asleep behind the wheel, from my perspective, when they announced that they've ended no-knock warrants, and yet we see the evidence is not there that that is what they did. Now, in terms of the White House weighing in on this current situation, it's almost too little too late. Although I am glad that Biden is weighing in, they have the power to ban no-knock warrants at the federal level, and I believe that many states would follow.
I'd like to
Ben Crump. Oh, Juan.
To go back to Ben Crump, I wanted to ask you, given the fact that this country has more legal gun owners than any place else in the world, forget about the illegally owned guns. Here you have Mr. Locke in his sleeping in an apartment, a legal gun owner. People break down the door, come in, and he reaches for his gun. Have you heard anything from the National Rifle Association or any gun advocacy organization condemning the police and standing up for Amir Locke?
Well, you know, you asked a question that paints the scenario because a picture is worth a thousand words. And you imagine a lawful gun owner who's exercising their Second Amendment rights, because Black people in America have a right to the Second Amendment, just like any other citizen. And when you think about the fact, whether it's Philando Castile in Minneapolis, whether it's Corey Jones in Palm Beach, Florida, these lawful gun owners who were killed by police, you know, we often said, where are these gun lobby groups? Where are these NRA-type groups? And, you know, I had to take my foot out of my mouth on this here, because for the first time, the Minnesota Gun Caucus issued a statement, and they said Amir Locke did what any reasonable, law-abiding, licensed gun-permitted owner would have done, that you have somebody come into your home unannounced, and you are saying, are they burglarizing me? You're not knowing why somebody would break into your home. And the first thing you do is you get your weapon to try to defend your family and defend your castle. And so I thought that was very, very profound that you had this gun lobby finally, for the first time in my lifetime, speak up for the rights to Black people to be able to say the Second Amendment applies to us too, the Castle Doctrine applies to us too, self-defense applies to us too when the police break into our home. I mean, and we have to remember that this no-knock warrant is disproportionately executed against Black and brown people. 82% of the people who had their houses broken into by the police, talking about a no-knock search warrant, and Louisville prior to Breonna Taylor 2 years prior, 82% were Black people. And you know, 62% of them lived in one Black section of town. And it's important to note that in most of these no-knock warrants, they found absolutely nothing.
Before we end, we only have a minute. I want to ask about the federal civil rights trial that's underway for the three former Minneapolis police officers in connection with the murder of George Floyd. The proceedings are getting underway again this week after the court delayed the trial after the judge revealed one of the defendants in the case tested positive for COVID-19, the officers J. Alexander King, Thomas Lane, and Totao. You represent the family, of course, of George Floyd. Ben Crump, if you can talk about the significance of this trial. Two of these officers were on the third and fourth day of being cops.
Yeah, Amy, what's so important about this is obviously Derek Chauvin's conviction was important. However, the culture of policing has to be held accountable. And, you know, oftentimes they say, you know, where this was one bad apple, they're the good cops. Well, the good cops have to speak up when they see the bad cops violate the constitutional rights of minorities and kill us. And so this trial is very important because we're looking now at the culture of policing in America. And just like with Amir Lott, the policy killed Amir more than those bullets. Well, the policy and the culture of policing killed more Black people than oftentimes the bullets.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I also want to comment that it was the judge in the Derek Chauvin trial that signed the no-knock warrant in the case of what ultimately led to the killing of Amir Locke. Ben Crump, leading civil rights attorney, attorney for the families of both George Floyd and Amir Locke, and Nikema Levy-Armstrong, Minneapolis-based civil rights attorney, activist, and founder of the Racial Justice Network, former president of the Minneapolis NAACP. Nikema, now you can go and tend to your baby, and all our best wishes to your baby.
Thank you so much.
Next up, we go to Oakland, where a group of teachers have entered the eighth day of a hunger strike to protest a plan to close and merge over a dozen schools for mostly Black and Latinx students. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show in Oakland, California, where protests are continuing over a proposal by the Oakland Unified School District to close and merge over a dozen schools. Critics say the move would disproportionately affect Black and Latinx students in low-income areas of Oakland. Tonight, the Oakland School Board plans to vote on the closures after nearly 2,000 people logged on to the Oakland Unified School District School Board meeting to give public comment about the closures, including parents, teachers, and students. We're joined now by Moses Omolade. He's a community schools manager at Westlake Middle School in Oakland, part of a group of educators on hunger strike protesting the proposed school closures. Thank you so much for joining us. I am sure you are weak. This is day 8 of the strike. You began on the first day of Black History Month. First, how are you feeling and why are you doing this?
Well, thank you for having me, Amy. And before I get in, I would like to invite my ancestors, Yoruba people. I would like to invite the ancestors of the land that I stand on, the Ohlone land, as well as the ancestors of the land you stand on, the Lenape land. How am I feeling? I'm feeling charged by my community. I'm feeling obviously weak in the body, but the spirit is strong. I'm feeling leveraged to push back against systemic racism that's happening in our communities. Why we're doing this is just very straightforward and clear. Systemic racism has run rampant in our communities for far too long, and this is never one of those times. To have community hubs in our neighborhoods be shut down without, or attempted to be shut down without community engagement is just not something that we're going to stand for. And that's what's currently happening. The school board is attempting to close predominantly Black and brown schools without engaging us at all. So we are deciding to push back. We are deciding to make noise and to cry foul about the reasons in which they're choosing to close our schools, because balancing the budget, especially when it's only 2% of your budget on Black and brown bodies, is not something that's acceptable.
And Moses Omolade, the involvement of the students themselves, I understand there have been walkouts at some of the middle schools there. Could you talk about the students themselves standing up on this issue?
Yeah. We have been excited to witness students take charge. You know, our students were upset. As you can imagine, during a global pandemic, to be sorting through mental health issues, to be struggling already, and then to be told that your school will be taken away from you, to be told that relationships will be severed, to be told that little siblings you expected to go to your school will no longer go, that you don't have an opportunity to go to school you desire to. They were upset. So it was very exciting to see them charged up and willing to head into the streets to let the district know that they won't sit silently by, to take charge and command of their own lives, which is something we've been constantly trying to teach them. And we are teaching young folks that you are allowed to push back on things that you feel are not right.
Just want to say something. You know the struggle well. You were involved in one in New Brunswick, New Jersey.
For me, well, no.
Oh, no, I was talking to Juan.
State University.
I was just talking to Juan Gonzalez in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Very, it sounds eerily similar, Juan.
Yeah, so that was a major school downtown that was being closed by the big hospital chain, a school that was 94% Latino, and they wanted to expand, so they just closed down the school with despite hundreds of parents and students protesting. So, and this has been happening. It happened in New York City when under Bloomberg, 25 schools were closed. It happened in Chicago under Rahm Emanuel. So it's been a process in all these major cities now. What is the argument that the Oakland school board says why they have to close these schools?
It's a laughable one. And one that I was really glad to witness. They proposed it at the board meeting. They were on full display and showed these magic numbers and gave reasons that were antiquated as to why they want to close our schools, which were that our schools are under-enrolled. And as we know, and they don't speak about, is that a lot of our students are going to the charter schools that they've allowed to be here, but also gentrification is impacting our communities. But small schools is something that all affluent neighborhoods aspire to have. So why do we not deserve small schools? Another reason was to save money for them, which was about $14 million, which only equates to about 2% of their budget. There are about many other options they can choose as to how to save this money versus using black and brown bodies and taking away community hubs that have been in our communities for over 150 years at the stroke of a pen or at the click of a Zoom button.
Moses Omolade, the vote is tonight. I mean, it is astounding that 2,000 people logged into the school board meeting. What exactly is being voted on? Just simply whether the schools will close?
They're voting on school closure and mergers. And what that means is they've chosen that certain schools they would like to merge and put them together. And then the year after that, they'll dissolve and become one school. So that will be voted on tonight, and chances are we are very clear that what they're going to do is the divide and conquer tactic, which they've used for a long time, take some schools off that list so those schools will quiet down and allow the others to close. But right now we're not stopping. This movement is no school closures at all and no mergers at all. So Sanjay and I will be on this until they decide to inject some humanity into the process by which they choose to close schools and engage with our community about these choices.
And what's your assessment of the political leadership of Oakland in the face of this? Are they 100% behind this, or can they be moved to pressure the school board?
They can be moved. I mean, I think anyone can be moved. We're humans at the end of the day, you know. It's been laughable, their approach so far. They have not come out to see us. Gavin Newsom hasn't come out to see us, and we've demanded that many times over. We've asked Tony Thurmond to come out. We've asked the board to come and speak with us. And the mayor has come out and said, yes, they deserve to close these schools, Mayor Libby Schaaf, and has yet to actually provide proper reasoning. We have no numbers. Anyone looking at these numbers will kind of laugh at it. So leadership in Oakland, in the state of California, have been laughable so far. But we, you know, have open hearts and love and desire to meet and sit with them and break bread with them, ideally someday, and talk about the reasons why our communities need to stay open.
We want to thank you so much for being with us, and we'll report tomorrow on what happens in the school board vote tonight, which I believe is 6 o'clock Pacific time, 9 o'clock our time on the East Coast. Moses Omolade is a community schools manager at Westlake Middle School, part of a group of educators on hunger strike protesting the Oakland Unified School District's proposal to close or merge over a dozen schools. This is day 8 of the strike. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
We all make choices about alcohol. Kids make choices whether to drink or not.
Bye, Dad. Remember, I'm going to Alex's party tonight and sleeping over.
Hey, Em. Remind me about that party again.
And adults make choices whether to talk about it. That's true of parents and every other trusted adult in a kid's life. Kids want to know our expectations, and they want honest answers in everyday conversations. So talk with your kids and help lead them on a positive path. Because when you talk, they hear you. Learn more at underagedrinking.samhsa.gov.
Let's just keep the music going. How about some Hoodoo Gurus? I want you back. It's the Viva La Mock radio program here on 88.3 WRCT.
I can still recall the time she said she was always mine, and she lived.
Tell me how it really is. She puts it out there.